coming in the face of national trauma, say hello to the irresponsible young Jew.
Professor Weiss, we're now going to begin your lecture, the sixth lecture in our series, on Tevye's daughter, Shprinsa.
Yes, this is the most painful, I suppose, of all the stories. Painful in the sense of being the most depressed. It starts off as if it might be as cheerful as the first story, because, after all, this is a romance which should work out. Tevye is delivering his dairy products. He goes to the big city and he meets a widow who buys his cheese and appreciates him very much. And she happens to have a son who has lost his father. Her husband has died. There's no one to bring up this boy, and he's become something of a rich playboy. And she's not satisfied with that. And so she actually appeals to the dairyman. Maybe you can sort of take him in hand a little bit, someone as responsible as you. And so Tevye likes this prospect, and so he invites Aronchik to come out to the country for a day, maybe bring his friends along, and you will be fed well, and maybe you will become a little bit more responsible. Maybe you will like to be a Jew a little bit more than you seem to be. Maybe I can instill some Jewish values in you. And so Aronchik comes out into the country, and lo and behold, he meets Tevye's daughter, Shprinsa, and he is attracted to her, she to him. Everything should work out well. So we look forward to that for a change after all these daughters who have not married so well from Tevye's point of view. How strange that this then should turn out to be the most tragic story of all. So that's what we're about to see. The story of Shprinsa. Every once in a while, the writer Shalom Aleichem came up against a situation that he could not control. When a story called for an ending that he did not want to provide, he occasionally broke through the fiction to let us know that one part of him could not do as the other part of him would have liked. It's very strange, but he lets us know this in the way he concludes or fails to conclude certain stories. So something of this kind seems to have happened at the end of Chava, after Tevye has declared his daughter dead and warned the family never to mention her name. We usually begin a lecture by quoting from the beginning of our episode. But this time I'd like to return to the conclusion of the previous episode, Chava, to see where we left Tevye the last time. He is telling Mr. Shalom Aleichem, his faithful listener, how he refused to stop for his daughter in the woods. He begins to say the afternoon prayers. The louder he prayed, the more everything in him cried, Chava. But he continued praying anyway, and later never told a soul about the meeting with Chava, though he found out where she and her husband lived. Just let anyone try to worm it out of me, though. My enemies won't live to see the day that I complain. That's the sort of man that Tevye is. Still, I'd give a great deal to know if everyone is like me, or if I'm the only madman of my kind. Once, for example, but do you promise not to laugh at me? Because I'm afraid you'll laugh. Well, once I put on my best clothes and went to the station in order to take the train there, I mean to where he and she lived, I stepped up to the window and asked for a ticket. Where to? Says the ticket seller. To Yehupetz, I say. Yehupetz, he says? I never heard of such a place. Well, it's no fault of mine if you haven't, I say. And I turn right around, walk home again, take off my best clothes, and go back to work, to my little dairy business with its horse and wagon. How does the saying go? Ish lefalo ve'adam lavodosoy. The tailor to his needle and the shoemaker to his bench. Ah, you're laughing at me anyway? What did I tell you? I even know just what you're thinking. You're thinking what a screwball Tevye is. If you ask me then, Ad kan oimrim b'shabbos hagodol. It's time to call it quits for the day. Be healthy and well and drop me a line now and then. For God's sake, though, remember what I told you. You are not to breathe a word about this or put it in any of your books. And if you absolutely must write about it, write that it happened to someone else, not to me. As it says in the Bible, Vayishkachehu, me, Tevye the dairyman, please forget. There's so much here. We will barely scratch the surface of it. But Vayishkachehu, right, and he forgot him, is from the dramatic point in the story of Joseph when he is in prison under Pharaoh. Joseph has proven himself an uncanny interpreter of dreams, but when the time comes that the chief butler should have brought Joseph to the attention of Pharaoh, the Bible tells us, yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, he forgot him. Widely used in Yiddish speech when you want to say that the good you did someone has been forgotten, it's used here by Tevye asking to be forgotten, as though the shame of this episode deserves to be laughed at, laughed off, not in any cathartic way like the line about the cholera epidemic in Odessa, but just plain erased from the story of Tevye altogether. Shalom Aleichem does something we would call very modern here by breaking into the realism that he's worked so hard to establish, to remind us that we are in a work of fiction, right? Tevye asks to be forgotten. Shalom Aleichem does something different but analogous when he reminds us that there is no real Yehupitz and thus no real story like the one he is telling. When their literary partnership began, Tevye hoped that the publicity would bring him customers. Now, once again, he is ashamed for what is happening in his life. He knows that this story has brought him just the opposite. Having held firm against Chava, Tevye has gone against the softer part of his nature, and he wants to get out of the fiction in which he figures. The author is in the same place. He too has done something which is uncharacteristic for him. Nonetheless, as we see, Shalom Aleichem published this story after all, because when you are in the business of writing, you continue writing. When you are in the business of being a dairyman, you return to being a dairyman. And when you are in the business of being a Jew, you go on being a Jew. So much still to spin out in that, but you see that the main point here that everybody struggles with is that Shalom Aleichem tips his hand. Tevye, in effect, is telling us that this did not happen really, that there is no Yehupitz, and that he was chasing after something. Something went awry, and wants deeply to draw our attention to the fact that I don't know how to pull this out of the hat. Something like that. So a year and a half later, in 1907, Tevye is back again, and in part because bad times for the Jews had made it a boom time in modern Jewish culture and in the development of both Yiddish and Hebrew literatures. Yiddish daily newspapers were vying for Shalom Aleichem's stories. And isn't this interesting? This corresponds to Tevye's observation at the beginning of the Sprintz's story that for all the national crises, his dairy business was booming. Have we ever had a summer season here? They've come flocking to Boyberik from Odessa, from Rostov, from Yekaterinoslav, from Mogilev, from Kishinev, thousands of Jews. It seems that the Constitution is even worse where they are because they haven't stopped running in this direction. So for both Shalom Aleichem, the Yiddish writer, and Tevye, the rural dairyman who depends on these fleeing customers, the frantic Jews of Russia drive up their business. So in making the transition from Chava to Sprintze, we've passed the halfway mark in these stories, and so maybe it's time to take stock of how the fourth daughter fits into the design of the whole. And since this story cycle was being written, let me emphasize still again, in actual time, in actual history, to see where this episode stands in the life of the author and in the history of the Jews. As we've said, every episode in the life of Tevye corresponds to what is happening in the Ukrainian district around Kiev, the fictional Yehupetz, and reflects the mood of Shalom Aleichem, who invests more of himself into Tevye than into any of his other characters. It was a grim time all around. Violence against the Jews was escalating in Russia. Jews were fleeing in dramatic numbers, with over 250,000, mostly Russian Jews, arriving in New York during the peak years, 1881 to 1914. But the peak years here were 1906 and 1907, which is when these really almost 250,000 Jews arrived in those 2 years alone. What you and I and Jews everywhere haven't been through these past years, says Tevye to Mr. Shalom Aleichem when he catches up with him again. Pogroms, riots, troubles, the new constitution. Dear Lord, it doesn't stop. The muddled way in which Tevye sums up the troubles doesn't do justice to historical events that included Russia's defeat in the 1904 war with Japan, the epidemic of anti-Jewish violence that keeps escalating between 1903 and 1921, the uprising of 1905, and the subsequent granting of the Russian Constitution that was supposed to limit the Tsar's autocratic rule and introduce some civic rights, the Tsar's immediate nullification of most of what the Constitution demanded, ushering in a period of national dejection, one could say. As usual, when Tevye mangles the word constitution, we can't be sure whether this is a mistake that betrays his ignorance or whether he is expressing his verdict on its corrupting outcome. Tevye won't even deign to use the word properly. So we really never know which it is. Is he tripping up on this word or is he making fun of it? Because in fact, the constitution has become not even worth the paper on which it was written. So during the pogrom in Kiev in October 1905, before this story was written, Shalom Aleichem and his family had sought refuge in a local hotel while their Christian housekeeper protected their apartment from attackers. Shalom Aleichem wrote from their hotel in one of his letters, "On the 17th, we were granted the gift of the Constitution, gift in quotation marks, in the cause of which our brothers had shed their blood like water. And the same day, about 6 o'clock in the evening, the word went out to beat up the Jews and attacks came at them from every side." He describes how hopeful they were when they caught sight of the police and the Cossack soldiers in the streets below, only to realize that they had come to protect the attackers, not the Jews. Shalom Aleichem and his family left Russia almost immediately afterward in 1906. The story of Shprintze was written abroad. When Tevye interprets the Bible's repetitive description of the children of Israel's moving from one place to another, camping and journeying, vayisu, vayachanu, vayachanu, vayisu, to mean, if you're running to hide in my place, I'd better go hide in yours. He was speaking for Shalom Aleichem, who never found a permanent home again. Tevye's deteriorating situation in these stories corresponds then also to the worsening conditions of the Jews of Russia and to the disruptions in the life of the author. Now, deterioration is represented through the stories of the daughters, and we might have thought that it peaked in the adventure of Chava. In the previous three stories, Tevye tells of the threats to his way of life that came in the form of suitors who introduced values different from or antithetical to his. You remember, Motel the tailor spouts a respect for manual labor that undercuts the Jewish emphasis on learning and overturns the hierarchical system of yichus, inherited family standing. His challenge is very mild compared to Perchik's revolutionary zeal in the name of the communist future. And Chvedka, the second Gorky, stands for the non-denominational society that transcends religious categories. All three make their way past Tevye's defenses under the banner of love as the determinant of the daughter's marriages. Love may be merely the vehicle through which these values and ideals compete with Judaism, but functionally, practically, as we've seen, if love dictates marital choice over and above the community, no people can survive. As we've said, this is equally true for all other religious and ethnic groups. But as the archetypal diaspora society and a dedicated minority among much more populous nations, Jews face this challenge of love, romantic love, as the determinant of choice most acutely. So it's kind of, romantic love is kind of the fire-breathing dragon, and true love romance is the fire itself. Now, how did Sholem Aleichem and Tevye feel about romantic love? Tevye seems very proud of this capacity in each of his daughters. He writes, "I know my girls. Didn't I once tell you that when Tevye's daughters, God help us, fall for someone, they fall with everything they have?" And except in the case of Chava, when this puts his daughters at odds with him, he yields to their preference over some son-in-law that he may have for the moment preferred. So Sprinze ought to have been a happy summer tale, just like the opening story of Tevye's lucky break. Here, once again, the poor country Jew meets the wealthy Jew from the city, and their transaction is mutually beneficial. Delivering his dairy products to the wealthy vacationers, Tevye gets to know one of his customers, a widow with an only son who needs someone to take him in tow. Each party provides some service or advantage to the other, and thereby demonstrates that the economic chasm between them is no impediment to mutual self-help or mutual help as members of the same Jewish people. How often does it happen in a story that a young man and woman fall in love with the right person, right? With the person who satisfies more or less the community's idea of an appropriate match. One can't blame Tevye for rejoicing at the prospect of having this quiet daughter marry the man she loves, who will at the same time bring him, Tevye, the security that he's always craved and a chance to sit and study Torah, his long postponed ambition. And so I told myself, you fool you, why must you always think you know best? Why can't you admit the whole thing may be providential? Why isn't it possible that quiet little Sprinze is meant to be your salvation, your reward for all the hardship and heartache, which is this time considerable, so that at last you can enjoy yourself in your old age and live like a human being for once? Suppose your daughter is fated to be a millionairess. Is that really so terrible? Is that such a blow to your dignity? So the reader might even put Tevye's question another way. After so many stories of loss, can't Sholem Aleichem give us just one more happy ending? Here we seem to be so close to a happy summer romance. The widow's son, Aronchik, could really use a father figure who would try to rein him in, toughen him up, and make him assume some responsibility. That's what the widow asks of Tevye, after all, when she complains to him that although Aronchik was over 20 years old, all he cared about was horses, fishing, and bicycles. Presumably, Tevye, with his hard-won experience and disciplined work ethic, could be a good influence. He could also draw Aronchik closer to his Jewishness. Kiruv is the term Orthodox Jews use for outreach to non-Orthodox Jews to draw them closer to Jewishness and encourage them to live according to Jewish law. So Tevye is practicing Kiruv when he invites Aronchik to come with his friends to spend the holiday of Shavuot at his farm. And good psychologist that he is, he does not reprimand the young Jews when they arrive on horseback instead of walking there on a holiday. He introduces them to Jewish observance in the form of delicious Jewish food, just as Chabad does when it uses hospitality in this directed way. Now, let me just say here that the reference to Chabad is anything but random, because when Uncle says, "I'm told they call you Tevye," our man replies that they do indeed. And here we have the first and only hint of such a thing. Tevye says, "And when they call me to the Torah in the synagogue, it's even Reb Tevye, the son of Shneur Zalman." Now, Shneur Zalman of Lyadi was the founder of Chabad, and those identified with Chabad often carry these names. So here we really have a clue of exactly who Tevye is and where he stands within the Jewish family. So why couldn't Shalom Aleichem just this once give us a true love romance where everyone is reconciled to the union of Shprintze and Aronchik? Tevye wants it desperately, and he feels if God were just, if good things happened to good people, he would be blessed with at least one Cinderella daughter. We can't know what was in the author's mind, but I think we realize why this simple story could not have a happy outcome. Times have changed, and Jews have changed over time. In 1895, the rich Jew of Yehupetz, renting a dacha in Boiberik, was still wearing a skullcap, still speaking a juicy Yiddish, still imbued with the same values as the logger who went out of his way to bring home his wife and daughter. That Jew doesn't allow his children to make fun of this simple man. He doesn't take advantage of Tevye's poverty. The still observant rich man knows that in the Jewish tradition, more is required of the wealthy than of the poor. Generosity, consideration, refinement that is expressed in their attitude to people. He considers himself the custodian of his wealth rather than its privileged owner. Now, the resemblance between Tevye's opening story and this one a dozen years later illumines the contrast between the rich Yehupetz Jews then and the present family from Yekaterinoslav. The coarsening of Jews in the process of assimilation is reflected in the uncle who confronts Tevye in this story. He has come to get his nephew out of what he considers an unfortunate scrape with some poor country girl. He sends for Tevye and wants to get straight down to business. And there is, of course, the inevitable miscommunication over the word affair in Yiddish chasene, which is used the same way to mean sort of a happening, which Tevye thinks refers to the wedding, but the uncle thinks of as entrapment. And the uncle minces no words. Either you're playing dumb or you really are dumb. Only how dumb can you be to have set my nephew up in the first place by pretending to invite him over for blintzes in order to introduce him to a young beauty who may or may not be your daughter. Now, it was, of course, Tevye who warned Aronchik that his daughter was not a suitable match for him. But Arnold, nay Aronchik, waved this off, pretending to take command of his life without the strength of character to deliver on his promises. The uncle has it backwards. It was his nephew who exploited the encounter with the dairyman and who now stands accused of having exploited the nephew. Yet in the typical plot of romance, the father could have been functioning in the role of a procurer. Does Tevye's subconscious implicate him in this tragedy? In other words, does he blame himself for really having brought this about? Does the romance itself, with the assumptions and expectations of romantic fiction, bear some responsibility for undermining the traditional Jewish way of life? After all, if Shalom Aleichem himself is bringing us romances, is that in some way functioning like the dairyman in bringing this match about that he is half hopeful about? So this is the second consecutive story that emphasizes Tevye's humiliation, this time not at the hands of a priest, of a Gentile, but but at the hands of someone who is for the time being still a fellow Jew. Worsening conditions include the assimilation of those Jews who have been living in the larger cities and trying to distance themselves from their religious observance, from the Yiddish language, and from any national obligations. Betrayal now comes in the form of Arnold, who behaves really in this story, just like the young sons of Polish landowners in stories of seduction in Yiddish literature, who think that they can carry off the Jewish girl with impunity since her father lacks the power to stop them. Tevye's helplessness at the uncle's insulting treatment of him reduces him to silence and to tears. I cried and cried until I had no tears left. Now, usually at such a point, Tevye would say, but Tevye is no woman, and pull himself together. This time, his daughter is the casualty of a crisis in which he is not entirely blameless, and his inability to protect her and her reputation and to secure her happiness unmans him as nothing has done so far. Now, once the Tevye stories became for Sholem Aleichem a way of confronting the trials of the Jews, this romance could not end happily. The trust in romance is never reliable, and the fantasy that Tevye allows himself to spin around this love affair is as misguided as his trust in Menachem Mendel's stock market schemes. Love in this sense is as impractical as speculation. Jewish literature was attracted by true love adventures as one of the trends in Western culture. Tevye and Sholem Aleichem are both tempted to believe in romance as the guide to marriage, one as the soft-hearted parent, the other as the writer who wants to produce marketable stories. But this story warns us that romance spins a web of hope where none is warranted, and Jews cannot afford that diversion. So Tevye's Kiruv, predicated on the assumption of national solidarity, was as chimerical as Sprintz's expectation of love. Tevye is implicated in this tragedy, I think, because his own fairy tale wish for wealth is the counterpart of Sprintz's falling in love in this way. To tell you the honest truth, if I wanted that match at all, it was less for the match's sake than for the feeling of satisfaction it would give me. The devil take you all, I'd be able to say to all the rich Jews of Yehupetz. Until now, it's been nothing but Brodsky, 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 but now you see who Tevye really is. So behind this, I think we understand that the political powerlessness of the Jew, which Tevye is feeling more and more, makes wealth the only lever of even partially autonomy. And that Brodsky, the rich Jew, the sugar magnet, represents, among other things, the right to reside in Yehupetz, the right to be taken seriously as a person. Yet Tevye is imprudent to indulge this daydream. He warns his daughter, but a little too late, and he challenges Aronchik, but a little too gently. His ambivalence and his own daydreams seem to blind him to the impending tragedy. And it's here in this chapter that Tevye compares himself to Job, the good man who suffers unjust punishment. At the end, he seems almost incapable of the resiliency that we've come to rely on because there is actually less basis for hope. Tevye's political helplessness and economic hardships are by now so compounded by the realization that the switch from Aronchik to Arnold signifies, believe it or not, a more serious rift than any of the things that came before, more serious even than Chava's attraction to a post-denominational illusion. At a time when Jews were being threatened as a people, assimilation was pulling the nation farther apart. Trying to shore up his family and bring Jews together, Tevye discovers a new menace in the combination of Aronchik's immaturity and his uncle's cynicism, which is the double face of the acculturating Jew. Tevye was never taken in by the priest, and he was never taken in by Chvedka, but he is taken in by this young man who turns out to act as a charlatan. He cannot protect his daughter in either case, but in this case, he feels that he shoulders a little of the blame. Now, silent Sprinza, she remains a mystery. We know too little of her to grieve for her. Am I mistaken that at the end of this story, one doesn't feel the heartache that one feels in the earlier two stories? We hardly know her at all. At best, we share Tevye's grief at losing a child. In fact, we know so little about her that some critics fill in the blank by suggesting that she must have been pregnant, which is a literary trope in this kind of plot, and it provides some readers with a stronger rationale for her suicide. So the literary critic Dan Miron writes quite definitively, Sprinze, here I quote him, realizing that she is about to bring shame on the heads of her parents, starts her downward slide toward lethal depression that will end in her self-destruction. By refusing to talk to her, Tevye reinforces her sense that her out-of-wedlock pregnancy is unacceptable. Now, this applies to Sprinze, the assumptions that are borrowed from other similar works of fiction, right? Actually, Tevye does try to alert both her and Aronchik to the risks that they are taking, and as for the pregnancy, I've looked in vain for any such real hint in the story. Sprinze is at an age when people feel things intensely, and her submerged emotions at having been so cruelly dumped and humiliated in a community from which she cannot escape is persuasive enough as a cause of death. There is no implied pregnancy that I know of in Romeo and Juliet, and they commit suicide. Sholem Aleichem wrote other stories about two girls who commit suicide because it was in fashion at that time of national depression. So Sprinze may have taken her life as jilted teenagers unfortunately sometimes do. But everyone is left, you see, with a huge act of interpretation if Sprinze is your focus here, because in fact, she does sink into a fatal depression, but the causes of it are not spelled out. Now, some readers are so uncomfortable with Tevye's telling of this story that they probe deeper. Janet Hadda was a Yiddish scholar and a trained psychoanalyst who, although she expresses due caution at treating a literary text as a living person, subjected Tevye's narrative, which she says is reminiscent of psychoanalytic free association, she submits it to the same scrutiny that she used in her treatment of patients. Though Sprinze is the victim, Tevye, the speaker, is the subject of her analysis. So Hadda suggests that Sprinze's idea of committing suicide, while certainly not directly suggested to her by her father, is nonetheless made available to her by Tevye's unusually frequent references to death in general and to suicide in particular. She picks up all Tevye's idioms, like lying 6 feet underground for being downcast, slaughtering someone without a knife for gratuitous insult. And although these are common Jewish expressions, Hadda believes that they are part of the subtext of the story's inclination toward death. And we can remember now, retroactively, you remember that the first, when he sees his daughter Hodel, and she says, I will never see you again, his first thought is suicide and drowning. It couldn't possibly have occurred to us seriously at the time, but now when we see this, we really see that such thoughts are on his mind. So in the passage from Chava that I trace to Jeremiah, where Tevye compares himself to a tree in the forest, Hadda pays attention not to the still standing oak, but to the Tevye's question whether there is any point to a naked tree with its lopped off branches. It would be better to chop the tree down completely and let that be an end to it, he says. So everyone notes the fluctuation that forms Tevye's personality, But Hadda thinks his expressed ambivalence, for example, to being a man and to the hardship of raising daughters and his unsatisfied hunger for self-respect and such things are so great that they play a role in the suicide of his daughter, who, quote, fulfills her father's unconscious wish for her by taking her life. And she writes, in the end, the suicide of Sprintze is more than the lonely decision of a desperate young woman, though it is that as well. Now, Hadda's psychoanalysis of Tevye tips the balance from the side of health to the side of illness, teasing out what leads to suicide in Sprintze rather than, as we have been doing, what reaffirms Tevye's moral and psychological balance. Whatever one thinks of this method and of her conclusions, they offer us several important insights, including the reminder that Sholem Aleichem and Sigmund Freud were contemporaries. Freud knew that great writers intuitively understood much of what he tried to prove through controlled investigation, and Sholem Aleichem was well aware that the humor he used to comfort his people was there to surmount an undertow of depression, often including his own. The undertow that pulls Sprintze to her death is present not only in Tevye, but in Yiddish folk culture, from which he draws some of his best lines. Now, both these men, Sholem Aleichem and Freud, were the result of a richly dialectic tradition, the intellectual opposition in Talmudic discussion having its emotional parallel and psychological equivalent in the Jewish balancing act that was always necessary between realism and faith, between what was actually happening to them and what they were committed to believing they would be their just desert if only they continued to be good Jews. So in his work on jokes and their relation to the unconscious, Sigmund Freud says much that is relevant to Sholem Aleichem's humor, and one of his insights bears on this story. It is our belief that civilization and higher education have a large influence in the development of repression, and we suppose that under such conditions, the psychical organization undergoes an alteration that can also emerge as an inherited disposition, as a result of which what was formerly felt as agreeable now seems unacceptable and is rejected with all possible psychical force. So he is talking here about this repressive activity of civilization brings it about that possibilities of enjoyment that we have had to censor in ourselves are lost to us. This is a huge part of Freud's concern that, you know, at our simpler stages of development, we had especially erotic kinds of pleasure, much more in free-floating forms of pressure. And the more civilized we are, the more repressed we are. And therefore, we have to give up these sources of pleasure. And who knew it better than a European Jew, right? So he writes, to the human psyche, all renunciation is exceedingly difficult. And he suggests that joking is a means of undoing this renunciation, the repression, and retrieving something that was lost. In other words, joking is a form of pleasure, and it's a special form of pleasure to those who practice repression. And Jewish joking, which is so intellectually keen, so much like Tevye's, right, is the pleasure principle of people who are to such a degree repressed. Right? This offers a terrific explanation for Jewish humor and the humor of a people that adheres to a high level of civilization and a people that is often forced to hold back because it cannot allow itself to aggress against those who do it harm. So this also offers a good explanation for Tevye's compulsive quoting, which is often a form of joking. Telling stories may be Tevye's talking cure, which is how one of Freud's patients referred to psychoanalysis. But his account of what happened to Sprinzer is almost too depressed for his customary humor. If Chava ends in this escape to fantasy, this story ends no less curiously in the opposite way, with an insistence on open-eyed realism without any verbal pyrotechnics. What was it I wanted to ask you? Oh, yes. Have you ever seen a drowned man? Never? Well, mostly one dies with one's eyes shut, but a drowned man's eyes are always open. I just thought you might know why that was. Of course, the immediate reference is to Sprinzer, right? But it is also to him. He is drowning with his eyes wide open, is he not? And this story is, in that sense, extremely strange, because the one thing that we have not seen Tevye, if we have not seen him say no in the previous story for the first time, he says no. Here, for the first time, he is the one who ends, no cholera epidemic in Odessa. No, it's, have you ever seen somebody drown with his eyes wide open? He has to look with his eyes wide open unerringly in order to see that person with eyes wide open. So Tevye's stories are not a talking cure in a sense. They're not looking for a cure. They are the cure. They are meant to be the cure for the incurable condition of Jewish life in desperate times, which is what this was. The depressed mood of this story invites a lot of thought about the historical moment, the author's situation, the evolution of Tevye, the function of the literary romance, and all the themes that this story touches on. But more than Tevye's psyche, let's not forget one of the things in this story, right? It's Arnold's cowardly betrayal that is the immediate cause of Sprinzer's suicide. So coming in the face of national trauma, say hello to the irresponsible young Jew.
This is a way to read the story as a judgment against the materialism that's now so enticing to the Jewish community that it in fact undermines the idea of Jewish community.
This is exactly right. And if you notice that there is a kind of ism behind every one of these stories, if one wanted to put it in those terms, positivism, communism, universalism. And in this case, I would say that Shalom Aleichem in some sense sees this as being even worse in terms of the problem that it presents. Conversion, for all that, is clear-cut. Materialism he sees as being far more damaging to the prospects of a continuing Jewish people. And here's the first point in this story of Sprinzer where we see that.